So I'm Nick Barton from Institute of Science and Technology Austria, and I'm interested in theoretical population genetics, especially of multiple loci evolving under selection and recombination. Okay. So thanks very much for the invitation to be here. I'm going to talk about the applications of branching process models in population genetics, and I'll start with the sort of very basic derivations, which I think almost everyone here will be familiar with. But probably it's useful just to go through the basics, first of all, just so that I can confuse everyone with population genetical notation, which will be a little bit different perhaps. And then I'll give a very rough, very hurried kind of overview of the variety of applications one can make in different population genetic questions. And in a way, this will lead into a more detailed talk by Daniel Weissman, who will follow me, talking about specifically the application of branching process models to modelling the rate of adaptation in sexual populations. Okay, so branching processes have a very long history, and I think trace back to a question asked by Francis Galton, Darwin's cousin, who asked about the probability of survival of a surname in a population, and first got mathematicians interested in this issue of branching processes, that is, of the statistical properties of individuals that are reproducing essentially independently of each other. And in population genetics, it's a very useful approach which applies when genes are evolving in very, very large populations, so that we can treat different genes as essentially independently reproducing entities. And this will be a good approximation, provided that the fate of these genes is decided as while those genes are still rare, that is, while they're so rare that they're unlikely to meet each other in the population. And so in population genetics terms, that requires that the strength of random drift in the population as a whole, which is at a rate of 1 over population size, is much weaker than the rate of selection on the genes that we're talking about. That is, n times s is a large quantity. So, to start with the most basic model of a branching process, if I write q at time t as the chance that a gene copy will be lost at some point in the distant future, given that it's present in a single copy at time t. So we could have, I suppose, if we define the time point of distant future that we're counting, we could define q at that point big T as equal to zero. In other words, it's definitely present at time t, chance of loss is zero. We take time back into the past and ask, what is the probability that it will be lost by that time in the future. So we have a very simple recursion then for this, which is given by the probability that a single copy will leave J offspring and that those offspring will all be lost. And the key assumption is that loss is independent, so that the probability that all J will be lost is just Q to the J. And if, for the sake of argument, we chose a Poisson distribution of offspring number, this distribution Poisson, with expectation lambda, then this goes to that recursion. So we have a very simple recursion for the probability of loss of an allele at a certain time point t. So I'll just use the notation. I'm not tall enough to reach up there, but just be convenient to write p plus q equals 1. So you can write it like that. Okay. So that's a bit awkward to deal with, but we can take a continuous time approximation on the assumption that rates of reproduction are close to 1. So we have a population that's close to a sort of critical state. And in that case, we end up with so we can obtain that just by taking a Taylor series expansion of this, assuming that p is small of order s, and that changes are slow over a timescale of order 1 over s. And you can see that if we have a constant selection coefficient, constant selective advantage of this gene, then the probability of survival tends to 2s. Okay, so standard population genetic result going back to the 1920s. Okay, so just as an aside, you can derive that by just taking a Taylor series expansion of this expression, which assumes a Poisson distribution. If you assume more generally that the distribution offspring number has some variance at V, for a Poisson, the variance would equal to the mean, and we're assuming that the mean is close to 1, so the population is increasing the numbers rather slowly. But if it, in general, has a variance offspring number V, then this is replaced by essentially a rate of random fluctuation proportional to that variance offspring number V. And sometimes we define this as, because it's a solution 2s over V, which we define as 2s times n e over n. In other words, we write the rate of random drift. I'm aware that this is that physicists have yet to be converted to the correct usage of the term drift, which I use to mean the rate of random fluctuation, the increase in variance of allele frequency per unit time. But if we consider a neutral allele with allele frequency p, change dp over a small time unit, the variance of that change over one generation is proportional to variance in offspring number v divided by twice, well, divided by the population size. We count n copies of genes in a haploid population. And often we write that as 1 over ne, the effective size giving the effective rate of random fluctuation, hence this ratio ne over n, saying essentially that increasing the rate of random fluctuation in reproduction, increasing the variance in the offspring number, reduces the probability of survival of a selectively advantageous allele in the face of random fluctuations. And I'll be coming back to this point, actually, that there's an important relationship between understanding the probability of survival of a selectively favorable allele, which gives us a measure, if you like, of the efficiency of natural selection in accumulating adaptations, and the rate of fluctuation of neutral alleles, which is something we can actually measure. The great bulk of data that we have in population genetics comes from massive molecular markers, which we assume are more or less neutral. And that gives us good information about the effective population size, about the rate of random drift. And it's important to know how far we can make inferences from that to understanding the rate of adaptation, which is, in some sense, what we care more about, but which is much harder to observe directly. Okay, so this is all very straightforward. Just to finish this sort of general introduction to the very simplest kind of branching process, to say that if we take this equation, I've presented that as an equation for the probability that an allele will survive, given that it's originating in a single copy at time t. You can also interpret it more generally as an equation for the generating function of the number of copies. So in fact, this is giving full information about the distribution of number of copies at some future time point, big t. So if we write p now as equal to the expectation of e to the minus omega j, where j is the number of copies at time big t.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
I'm slightly confused by the use of this v. So I thought that 2s is already a probabilistic approach where we already take into account random drift. So what is the role? So what is this v again?
So s is the expected rate of increase of the allele, averaging over random fluctuation. So in a sense, it's a deterministic term.
Okay. Yes.
V is the variance of this offspring number distribution. So we assume there's a distribution of number of copies which is close to 1 on average, which has a variance which, if we had a Poisson distribution, would be 1, and that's a kind of benchmark-based distribution, but in general would be usually larger than that.
So we use it as to define the deviation from the Poissonian.
That's right. Okay. And in fact, what V does really is set a timescale. You can, if you go to the continuous time limit, you can use V to set a timescale determined by the rate of random drift. And you can rescale everything to this standard rate of increase of variance of allele frequency, or and it's really setting a measure. This S here is multiplied by this factor because we have, if you like, a competition between two processes, the timescale of selection, rate of increase, and the timescale of random fluctuation set by this variance in offspring. I mean, biologically, you hardly believe that any population really ever does have a distribution offspring number given by Poisson or whatever. You can set up, obviously, many, many different kinds of models, say a model of bacterial evolution where individuals divide and they have either no copies if they die, two copies if they successfully divide, then you get a different ratio, different variants. Okay, so just to say that I sort of introduced this as giving you the probability of survival of an allele over a certain time, but you can interpret it more widely by basically setting up a different boundary condition. If you say that this is the generating function for, or the Laplace transform of the number of copies at the endpoint, time big T, and therefore you must have this boundary condition. If we have one copy at time big T, then P must equal e to the minus 1. We'll get there. And then if you just solve the same equation with a different boundary condition, then you get the generating function for copy number, and you can then differentiate it in the usual way and get the mean and the variance, etc., of copy number and get the full distribution. So although I'll be talking largely about fixation probability, the results immediately give you the whole properties of the distribution of copy number at some later time. Okay, so this is all, you know, very basic and rather trivial. It gets non-trivial if you extend everything to think about the evolution of a gene which can find itself in multiple or many different situations. And what I mean by a situation is essentially either a different spatial location, in which it may have a larger or smaller selective advantage, or a different genetic background in which it's associated with other genes at other loci which influence its reproductive rate. Okay. So we'll be thinking about genes which are reproducing, but reproducing in association with a spatial location, or for most of the talk, reproducing in association with other genes at other locations on the chromosome. So, all we do is just say that now we follow the probability of loss, given that we have a single copy in location or in genetic background I, and we have exactly the same equation, except that we now have this Q tilde, which is the probability of survival of a single offspring from a parent of type I. So we then have to have the relationship between this Q tilde at time, well, let's say time T plus 1, matter of definition, so basically there'll be a linear relationship between the probability of survival of a parent of type I, sorry, of a single offspring from a parent of type I, and the actual probability of survival of an offspring with an actual type K. And this relationship will be given basically by the probability that a parent of type I produces an offspring of type K. So you just have a matrix which gives the distribution of different types from a parent of a certain type. Okay. So then when you take the continuous time approximation, you get So we get now essentially the same equation, but one that depends on the selective advantage of type I, okay, and on the rate of transfer from type I to type K. Okay. I'm assuming here that this rate is small. Actually, you can solve it fairly obviously for transfer rates, which are rather high, but it's a lot easier to move to the continuous time approximation. Okay, for most purposes, that'll be okay.
Should it be pi squared?
Sorry? Yeah, it should be, sorry, I, k, I mean, it's the letters they are. Sorry, quite right. Okay, so before going on to sort of applications of this basic framework, just to say something a bit more general, suppose we're interested, and this is actually what we'd usually be interested in the chance of success of a randomly chosen gene, a gene sitting in a random location in the population. So we define the frequency, call it GI, of, let's say, genetic backgrounds in the population, which may be changing through time, and which will follow J. Follow that equation, okay? So we're imagining that, let's say, there are different kinds of chromosome in the population which are changing in frequency in some arbitrary way under selection, mutation, recombination, whatever, and that the rate of that rate of change is given by this matrix, okay? And we have then the frequencies of those different backgrounds changing through time. And we want to know about p bar, which is just the sum of probability fixations in background I weighted by the frequency of that background. And it's fairly easy to see just by multiplying this throughout by GI. Out again. I put sums everywhere, anyway. Okay, and then because this is given by this equation, this simplifies to give you, I'll write it up here, so this moves over there and gets absorbed in the rate of change of p bar, and you get this rather neat relationship which tells you that the rate of change of the average fixation probability depends on this term and on this term. And the actual transfer between different backgrounds disappears. This simplifies even further if the selective advantage of the type, the new allele, is independent of where it's sitting. So it has an advantage which is independent of spatial location or of genetic background. That would mean, in the latter case, that there's no epistasis, no interaction between the advantage of a gene and where it's sitting.
So what exactly your definition of M? So M is some transition probability, which is suitably normalized, so that G is invariant probability distribution.
Yes, so M is the probability, or it's the rate of transfer in a continuous time approximation here, the rate of transfer between a gene that's sitting in situation I in the parent and ends up sitting in situation K in the offspring. And that will be including contributions from migration, recombination, mutation, anything that can change the situation of a gene.
But not selection,
yeah. Well, no, it can include selection to the extent that these backgrounds are changing in frequency.
But selection is diagonal terms, so presumably you take it out.
Yeah, so this, it doesn't include selection on the allele that we're looking at. It can include selection on the various different backgrounds. So those backgrounds may themselves have selective advantages and disadvantages. So that this term does include the fact that, let's say we had, in the simplest case, we have a focal allele there, we're following the numbers of copies of that. It can sit in association with, let's say, a plus allele or a minus allele, right? here or here, and those themselves may be selected. Okay.
If you look over on the left, you know, there's no separate diagonal term in DTGJ.
Here.
On the left, DTGJ. There's no, he's left it in, it's still
yes.
in there.
The diagonal terms are in there, yes. So selection's having an influence which is in that matrix.
You assume that the frequencies of those backgrounds change deterministically.
Yes. So this whole framework is isolating the stochastic fluctuations on this focal allele, which is present in a few copies, but the backgrounds are definitely changing deterministically. If that isn't true, the whole thing's a nightmare, and you can't use a branching process. Okay. So. If you had to do the joint evolution, the joint stochastic evolution of lots of types in a population, then it's just very bad. But you can write down a diffusion approximation. In a sense, this is a limit of a diffusion approximation in which one of the types is at very low frequency and the other types are in large number. And maybe anticipating a bit an objection which I'm sure someone would make later on in the talks, I'll try and preempt it. If I'm doing a model in which genes are moving across a very large number of genetic backgrounds, let's say we had a model with 10 or 20 different loci under selection, they're 2 to the 10 or 2 to the 20 alternative backgrounds, then using this kind of deterministic background evolution gets pretty dubious, and in fact the whole thing will break down at some point because the numbers of each of these backgrounds may get small, and then you can't ignore stochastic fluctuation in them. But it's well defined provided we have a limited number of backgrounds relative to an extremely large population size.
It may not be that bad because you're really only interested ultimately in the fitness of the background that the thing is hooked up to.
Yes.
And again, if there are very many backgrounds.
Leverage out,
right?
Yeah.
So you'll be concerned actually if the background sort of starts condensing into just a few genotypes. but I think we can have the discussion.
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I don't have a very good feel for when it's going to work and when it won't work. But anyway. Okay, so we have this result, which if S now, the advantage of the allele we're considering, is independent of the background or location, then that's equal to S P bar minus P squared bar over 2. And so this is telling us essentially that the average fixation probability will always be reduced to the extent that there's variation in fixation probability across backgrounds. So that's quite a useful result. It gives you a bound on fixation probability. It tells you that essentially heterogeneity structure in the population is going to reduce the efficacy of selection to the extent that there really are different prospects for genes in different situations. Just finally, one other sort of general bit of, I suppose, notation. We can define something called reproductive value, which is equal to this. And this is basically the expected number of copies in the distant future that an individual of type I is expected to leave. And you can normalize it so the average reproductive value in the population is 1, but it varies across backgrounds, across different types. And this was a concept actually introduced by Fisher in 1930 to describe the different contributions an individual would be expected to make if, for example, individuals differ in age. What is the reproductive value of an individual at birth relative to an individual at age 10, 20, whatever? And it's been used more generally to describe the relative contribution to reproduction made by individuals of different types in a population. You can also, as we'll see later, use it to describe the value of individuals, unique individuals, and their contribution to future generations. But the point is that it's given by an equation rather similar to whichever equation we had here, this equation here. Okay, you can actually generalize it to that. You're really just deleting this term, which is due to selection on the focal allele, and this term, which is due to random fluctuations. And you can show that if there's a separation of timescales, if the movement of genes across different genetic backgrounds or different locations is very rapid, that is, this process is much faster than the timescale set by selection on the allele, then P is proportional to reproductive value. In other words, the contribution, the probability of fixation of an allele in a certain situation on a certain genetic background is proportional to the reproductive value, the expected number of copies of that. It's a fairly obvious relationship. And also, there's a relationship which tells you that the rate of random drift, 1 over NE, is proportional to the variance in reproductive value across different backgrounds. So the rate of genetic drift is fundamentally determined by the variance in prospects of individuals in a structured population, as long as you have this fast mixing criterion. And this is closely related then to this relationship, because if the fixation probability is proportional to reproductive value and varies across backgrounds due to that variation in reproductive value, then we have here essentially a variance in reproductive value term coming out, which leads to that result I gave you before, that the fixation probability is reduced to the extent that there's variance in reproductive value across backgrounds. But to emphasize, that doesn't hold if the time scale of mixing across backgrounds is similar to or slower than the time scale of selection. Okay, so that's the end of the sort of generalities. And I'll just list rather quickly a whole set of applications. So one is spatial heterogeneity, in which we have selection here, which is a function of position. And so the equation we have, I'm bundling a bit of chalk, is, well, we'll assume that things are at an equilibrium, not changing through time, naught there. We can make a continuous space approximation. So we imagine a situation where selection is a function of location, S of x. Fixation probability is a function of where the mutation is. Let's say S is negative everywhere except in some region there. Then this is the sort of linear part of the equation. Then we have minus p squared over 2. Usual. And if you solve that differential equation, you get the fixation probability as a function of where the mutation is. And basically, what will happen is that it'll be approaching, but somewhat smaller than, 2s in that region, and it'll decline outside that, so that an allele that arises here would be disadvantageous, would be eliminated if it weren't for migration, but it has some chance of diffusing into a region where it's favoured and being picked up by selection. So this sort of has a rather straightforward interpretation, but it allows you to calculate the chance that selection will pick up an allele, even if it's in a region where it's not actually favored, if it can diffuse into a region where it is favored. So that's straightforward. You can come up with various other questions about spatially heterogeneous populations. What I'll concentrate on, though, is genetically heterogeneous populations, movement across genetic backgrounds by recombination and mutation. And start with something that's called background selection. And that refers to the effect on an allele of selection against deleterious mutations in the background, in the genetic background. And so we're imagining, let's say, a linear chromosome. We have a focal locus that we're looking at there, and we're asking about the fate of a mutation that arises there. But there are various deleterious mutations occurring elsewhere in the genome. So this is a chromosome, distance measured in recombination, by recombination rates. And we have, let's say if we had definite locations in the chromosome, we have a certain rate of mutation at this site, rate of selection, S against deleterious mutations, and therefore an equilibrium frequency mu over s. And in the simplest case, if the effects of these mutations are independent, if there's no epistasis, if fitness is the product of effect of this locus, then the population will be in so-called linkage equilibrium. The frequency of any particular genotype will be the product of the allele frequencies. And you'll have a whole range of genetic backgrounds then, which will vary in the number of bad mutations, from zero to whatever. The mean will be number of sites times mutation rate over S, and you have a Poisson distribution there. The number of copies of the fittest combination may actually be very small. It'll be something like e to the minus n mu over S. The mean fitness will be the mean number of bad mutations times their selective effect, and it's a multiplicative model, so it's e to the minus n mu, famous result due to Haldane, that the depression in mean fitness of a population is independent of the selection coefficient against the bad alleles, assuming that mutation is weaker than selection at each locus, and therefore the load is just e to the minus numbers of mutations per generation, assuming no epistasis. So we may have n mu of order 1, perhaps giving a substantial load. If that's true, and if selection against each bad mutation is rather weak, the numbers of bad mutations per chromosome may typically be very, very large. And indeed, we each carry, you know, many thousands of deleterious mutations at one locus or another. So we have this rather broad distribution of quality, if you like, of genetic backgrounds. And the probability that an allele that arises on a very good background that fixes is much higher than the probability of an allele fixing if it's on a bad background. But the dependence in this relationship will depend very much on the rate of recombination, the rate at which an allele that arises in a bad background can move on to a good background, and vice versa. So, in fact, it's easy to write down the equation that governs this, at least in principle. So, I'll kind of shift notation a bit and define the backgrounds as a vector of noughts or ones, which determines whether or not you have a good or a bad allele at each location. And then, again, we'll assume an equilibrium, and we'll assume that there's a rate of recombination at position I. We'll assume a single crossover per generation, so that in any generation, this particular chromosome may cross over with some other chromosome at this location with I, and the rate of those kinds of recombination events is Ri. And then we also have a sum over the frequency Y of the genome with which you're mating. And that transfers the focal allele from background X to a recombinant background, which has X to the left and Y to the right. Okay. And obviously you could have other kinds of recombination which have Y to the left and X to the right. Then we also have a sum over mutation rates, and we could write that as a transfer of genes from background X to background X star, which differs by a mutation at site I. And we'll assume that mutation is always from good to bad, so we have unidirectional mutation, which will be a good approximation. And then we have plus reproductive rate, a uniform advantage little s for the focal allele, minus a disadvantage s, which is a function of genotype you're on. Relative to the mean, and then minus this drift term there. So this is, in principle, simple. It's a polynomial, but it's kind of a big polynomial if you've got lots of loci. You can solve it for, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 linked loci, and determine the effect of this sort of background selection. And it's interesting, it's different from the effect on neutral diversity. So there's been a lot of work on the effect of heterogeneous genetic backgrounds, particular background selection, on the structure of neutral diversity. And this is really within the framework of the so-called structured coalescent. I'm not sure whether to draw trees this way up or this way up, so I'll draw them sideways for the moment, just to compromise. Let's suppose we sample a gene from here, from a particular genetic background, and we sample a gene here and a gene here, and we trace their ancestry back in time. As we trace it back, they can move, the genes can move from this background to some other background by recombination or by mutation. Going backwards in time, what happens is that if a mutation occurs, going back in time, you move on to a better background, a less loaded background. In other words, one of these may be a raise, so you move on to, let's say, this background, or you may move on to a less loaded background by a recombination event. So you can move between backgrounds by recombination and mutation. And if two lineages happen to move back into the same background, they have a chance of coalescing and actually deriving from a single ancestral type. So you actually have a very simple model of random movement of lineage, ancestral lineages between backgrounds, going back in time, and coalescing ultimately in one common ancestor. And using that approach, you can show that for a linear chromosome, rather surprisingly, the rate of coalescence is increased, or the effective population size is reduced, by a factor which depends just on the density of deleterious mutations per map length, okay, independent of their selective advantage, or sorry, their selective disadvantage. And that's a surprisingly robust result, as long as the selective disadvantages aren't too big. If you look at, if you solve these rather horrible equations numerically, you find that the effect. Sorry, yeah.
I'm getting lost here a little bit. This is a selective disadvantage of what?
Of the bad mutations. So here, I'm talking about the structured coalescent results for neutral alleles sampled from within a population where there are bad mutations occurring with various selective disadvantages. And you can show then that the reduction in genetic diversity, or the reduction in effective population size, the increase in the rate of coalescence, is determined solely by the density of deleterious mutations per map unit. This comes out of results for a single linked locus, in which you get a relationship which does depend on the selective coefficient and the map position. But then you take that and you show that the effects are, to a reasonable approximation, multiplicative across loci. You take the average over randomly scattered deleterious mutations at different sites, and you show that basically the relationship with selection disappears once you average over the map. Okay.
And the condition is that the mutation selection balance holds, so you're not in the ratchet regime.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. If you have the ratchet, then yeah, then it's different. So, and in fact, this whole framework is kind of awkward to extend to the ratchet, because then you're not in an equilibrium situation. Yeah. Okay, so I won't say any more than that, except to mention that the effects of the background selection on fixation probability is actually stronger than the effect on neutral diversity. Provided that the allele we're following is more weakly selected than the deleterious mutations. And in general, it's true that you can't predict, in general, the effect of selection, various kinds, on fixation probability from its effect on neutral diversity, which is a bit disappointing, because it means that it's then harder to, you know, make inferences from what we actually know about, which is largely about neutral diversity. Okay, so I should probably say very little about the effect of positive selection as opposed to negative selection, because Daniel's going to talk about that just now. But basically, you have the same setup. You now have alleles here that are at some frequency that are positively selected. This is sweeping through the population. So you imagine a series of selective sweeps where this locus has an allele that's displacing the original one, etc. Series of sweeps, various times, various locations in the genome. You can write down the same equations here, except that you now have a time dependence there. And you don't need to worry about mutation, ignore mutation. But you still have these recombination terms and these selection terms. This is now positive selection, etc., etc. Basically the same setup. If you have a single sweep which is interfering with a weakly selected allele, that is, if the advantage little s here is much weaker than the advantage of the established sweep big S, then you can show that the effect of the sweep is essentially a random catastrophe happening, essentially reducing the number of copies by some ratio, some factor. And that factor for weak selection is something like 1 minus big S over little s, where big S is the advantage of the sweep that's going through, that's tending almost always to knock back the frequency of the favorable allele, which is struggling to increase from small copy number. And that's weighted by the ratio of recombination to selection. Okay. And just to mention that this is very similar in form to the formula for the reduction in neutral diversity, okay, in which essentially, again, a neutral allele will be pushed down in frequency by a sweep that occurs on the opposite background by this ratio. But the factors in here are different. And generally speaking, in fact, under the assumptions of the model, this 2ns will be much larger than this, and therefore the effect of sweeps on neutral diversity is much weaker, in fact, than the effect on favorable alleles.
Yeah? So a number of assumptions are inherent in what you're presenting, and in particular, it's that you're dealing with clonal populations and...
No, I'm absolutely not talking about clonal populations. This is recombination.
Okay, but you're still dealing with an experimental system in which genetic communication is either there or it's not. And in the real world, there's a much longer continuum of genetic communication. So what I'm wondering is, I guess, the extent to which data from populations in complex environments actually demonstrate behavior like this.
Okay, so of course there's a big question about, you know, what evidence we have for any of this elaborate theory. Clearly the data we have is very, very primitive in a way, and much coarser than anything we can sort of model here. But we do have data on the reduction in neutral diversity as a function of recombination rate, particularly in Drosophila. And this was actually an observation that really stimulated the whole field about 20 years ago, the observation that in regions of the Drosophila genome with low recombination, you get substantially lower genetic diversity. And that can be explained actually rather well by either the background selection model, and many people would argue that it can be explained entirely by background selection, but it's also consistent with a certain rate of selective sweeps, because both of those are mediated by recombination versus selection. And in fact, there have been detailed models of the actual amount of neutral diversity as you go along the Drosophila chromosome. And fitting that to models of background selection, and you can get quite a good fit given the real parameters. But that's the sort of level in which you can work. And I'm not sure whether you're referring to complex real organisms that are living in a spatially heterogeneous situation, or genetic heterogeneity, or both.
Well, I'm thinking of both, and I'm thinking mm-hmm. of microorganisms.
Yeah.
And so where, in fact, effective population sizes are.
Yes. Well, but in fact, this whole framework makes you think about whether effective population size is even a useful concept, because it could well be that the NE that we observe, which is basically an inference from levels of neutral diversity, okay, if those levels are set by multiple selective sweeps occurring in a rather complicated way, then it may have nothing to do with population size. And in fact, this was the original reason why Maynard Smith and Hay in 1974 established this whole theory of hitchhiking and interference amongst selective sweeps. They established it because of the observation that neutral diversity was actually rather similar across a range of organisms with very different population sizes. And this was way back in sort of the early days of Alanzine surveys. But it was clear then that, you know, E. coli has more diversity than, you know, a typical mammal, but not vastly more. I mean, it's maybe five times more, but not five orders of magnitude more. Okay, and their explanation was that perhaps in populations that are very abundant, population size is completely irrelevant to the rate of loss of diversity. It's something to do with background selection, with selective sweeps, or whatever. I mean, we still don't know that, but that was sort of the key question that we're trying to address.
So in this formula, doesn't it matter when this sweep occurs?
Oh yeah, absolutely does. So I'm sort of leaving out, and I think Daniel will talk a bit more about this. If you actually just solve the very simple single sweep, single locus equation, you have two backgrounds. So you have the probability of fixing if you're in the bad background or the good background. You want to know the average p-bar across those two. It depends, of course, when the allele arises relative to the sweep. So let's say the sweep goes through at this time. That's the 50% point of the sweep. If the allele arises after the sweep's completed, there's no effect. So we have p-bar equals 2s there. If it occurs a long time before, then it'll get established before the sweep happens, so there's no effect. There'll be a time, something like that, when fixation probability is reduced, maybe substantially. Okay? And this formula here is an average over this area. And that's what matters, because you're assuming that the new mutation is arising at a random time relative to the sweep that's occurring. Okay? So you solve the equations, you integrate over time, do this averaging, and you get this formula. You could then do another averaging over the map to say what happens to an average mutation occurring at a random time at a random location, and then it will say a bit more. Okay, so I'll finish then, I should finish, by mentioning a slightly different application of this kind of framework, which is to the probability of fixation of an allele sitting in a particular individual in a real population. So now we're sort of moving away from this very sort of large timescale, rather abstract world, to think about a definite population which is described by a pedigree. So we have an individual here that has, let's hope, two parents. It's a sexual population that has two parents. And I suppose we might have some inbreeding and so on, etc., etc. But we have some kind of large, complex pedigree. But more or less, whatever the structure of that pedigree, as long as basically the pedigree is reasonably well mixed, you can ask about the contribution that genes in this individual, say, make to future generations. And this is actually something which you can almost imagine measuring nowadays. If you actually had that genome, that individual, that ancestor, dug it out of some cave somewhere, and you then had all of the sequences of all the genomes in the present-day population, you could actually identify, as long as this time span wasn't more than, let's say, 30, 40, 50 generations, you could identify which bits of this genome came from that ancestor. And what you see is that in the present-day population, most of that genome would have been lost, just by chance. But some bits of it would be present at rather high frequency. So, on average, if we say that there's no particular selective advantage or disadvantage to this individual, on average it will leave one copy of every gene. Okay? But there's a huge variance in copy number, so that after time t, the probability of survival of any particular gene goes as roughly 1 over t. And the expected number of copies conditional on survival therefore goes as 1 over that, as t. Okay? So after 50 generations, you expect to have a huge variation with something like 50 copies, but with a wide variation around that, of those small chunks that happen to survive. So you can ask then, what is the probability of survival then of a particular gene in a particular individual? And that's something which is in a way is measurable. And the surprising result you get is that after a fairly short time of the order of 10 or 20 generations, if you plot probability of survival against the reproductive value, the expected number of progeny, then you get a very tight relationship. That the probability of survival of an allele in this individual is directly proportional to reproductive value, basically for the reasons I explained before. There's a rapid mixing due to biparental reproduction. And maybe more surprising, if you ask about the full distribution of the contribution made by this individual, which includes the distribution of block sizes and the distribution of the number of copies, that is solely determined by reproductive value. And moreover, conditional on survival, it's the same for every individual. So conditional on a block surviving, which depends on reproductive value, you find that the distribution of number of copies is exponential with standard value equal to 1 over p. So the conditional distribution doesn't depend on any of the complexities of the pedigree, and depends, in a sense, solely on survival, which in turn depends solely on reproductive value.
Excuse me. So the last distribution is the distribution of sum of lengths of the chunks that are...
Sorry, no, I was confusing things, but I was leaping ahead of myself. Let's forget about all this block nonsense, right? That's just number of copies, right? So, okay, deleting steps. First thing is P, probability of survival, that portion of reproductive value, and determined entirely by it. There's a very tight relationship. Given an individual's reproductive value, you know the probability that any one of its genes survives. Moreover, you know that conditional on survival, the distribution number of copies...
Heritable? I mean, that's the reproductive value of the ancestor.
Yeah, and in fact, you can include models in which reproductive value is affected by selection. There can be selection on unlinked loci, which means that individuals vary enormously in reproductive value.
So this is neutral, or one over t?
This is for the neutral case, and I'm looking at a neutral allele embedded in a genetic background, which may be influenced by selection on unlinked loci, or it may be influenced by all sorts of stuff. It may include some sort of population structure, individuals moving between different locations or whatever. You have a complicated pedigree. But as long as that pedigree is, in a sense, well mixed, all of the properties of the pedigree...
Isn't that saying that as long as the pedigree doesn't matter?
Sorry?
As long as the pedigree doesn't matter, we get one over T.
Well, I suppose it is saying the pedigree, in a sense, doesn't matter, but it's not obvious that's true. And in fact, there are other quantities for which the pedigree does matter.
The statement that the pedigree is well mixed, meaning that the pedigree doesn't really have much influence.
Yeah, so I suppose the strongest statement would be the pedigree is well mixed under surprisingly broad conditions. So in fact, this stuff was stimulated by a couple of papers by Chang, and there was a paper in Nature by Roeder et al. So Chang showed that... quite recently, actually, it's surprising this wasn't done by people in the 19th century. It's a very simple question. So he showed that if you trace the ancestry of a present-day population back in time, you'll get at a certain time in the past, not that long ago in the past, of the order of log to the base 2 of population size, you'll get an individual who is an ancestor to all of the individuals in the present-day population. And if you go back a bit further, 1.77 times as far back, then you get a situation where all of the individuals in the ancestral population who left any descendants, all of those will be ancestors to everyone in the present-day population. In other words, we all share ancestry. And this is saying that over a timescale of order log n generations, there is a complete mixing in which we all share the same set of ancestors. And this stuff I've been describing here about the distribution of numbers of copies left, and in fact about more complicated properties of the genetic contribution, that's really an extension of that. It's saying that pedigrees are well mixed. As you say, it is sort of trivially saying, yes, pedigrees are well mixed, but they're well mixed under circumstances which are broader than you might think. For example, the Nature paper, following on from Chang's results, showed that if you took the level of population structure typical of humans, not that we really know what that is, but you made up some model of human migration, it really didn't slow down the mixing very much. It slowed it down from 30 generations to 40 generations or something like that. Basically, because it only takes one ancestor leaving a population, going somewhere else, to spread, if you like, your ancestry over very, very large numbers quite quickly. Because you have 2, 4, 8 ancestors as you go back in time. Okay, so I'll stop there. I've had my 60 minutes. Anyway, just to show that there are a lot of quite different kinds of application of branching processes in population genetics. So, but Daniel will give us more detail on one of them.